Welcome to Novelist Spotlight. This is Mike Consul, your host. In addition to being the host of this podcast and interviewing novelists, I am a novelist myself. I have three published novels. My latest is titled Lolita Firestone, a supernatural novel, and it is set in Sedona, Arizona and Cairo, Egypt. My previous novel is titled Family Recipes, a novel about Italian culture, Catholic guilt, and the culinary crime of the century. And my first novel is named Hardwood, a novel about college basketball and other games young men play. And that story deals with issues ranging from depression and racism to sex, religion, and university politics. All three novels are listed in the episode notes. I hope you will buy them, I hope you will read them, and I hope you will thoroughly enjoy them. Now, on with our program. In the spotlight is Sasha Vasiliak. She is a journalist and the author of the debut novel, Your Presence is Mandatory, now available for pre-order on all the major bookselling sites and soon to be published in the United States, Canada, Italy, Germany, France, Finland, and Brazil by Bloomsbury Publishing. She has written for the New York Times, Time Magazine, the Los Angeles Times, Harper Bazaar, NBC, USA Today, Narrative, and other media outlets. Journalist turned fiction writer. It's not unheard of by any stretch, but not as easy as one might think. Sasha, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And congratulations on the new novel, for which there must be some excitement given that Bloomsbury is launching this in multiple languages and in seven countries simultaneously. Is that, I mean, I don't usually see a debut novel hitting multiple countries and languages. Am I correct in assuming there's some excitement around this book that goes beyond you and your loved ones?
Yes, I think you are correct that there is some excitement about the book. I wanted to correct you that Bloomsbury is publishing it in the US and Canada, and the other countries that you've mentioned, each one has its own publisher. So these are foreign rights situations. So publishers in France, Italy, Finland, Germany, and Brazil, they bought this book very early on, kind of at the same time as Bloomsbury did, because there was excitement about it and still is. Partly because I went to sell this book, or my agent did, about a month after the war in Ukraine began. And because this novel is very much directly related to it, there was excitement, particularly in Europe, where they felt very much touched by the war there.
Well, there's something to be said about timing, no question about that. But also, obviously, you wrote a good novel that was in demand. Tell us about the novel. Give us the overview while sparing us the spoilers. And obviously, we don't want any spoilers, but tell us about the novel. What's the gist of it?
So this is a World War II novel. It's based on real events, and I will tell you more about that. And it's about a Soviet veteran who has a secret that could land him in the Gulag, in the Soviet camps, as well as his wife, children, and grandchildren, who are forced to live in the shadow of everything he has not told them. It is a story that stretches from World War II until the Russia-Ukraine war. So it's quite a long epic. It's a family saga. It has a KGB secret inside of it that propels the narrative. And it is based partly on my own family and a lot of research that I did on various subjects. But the story behind me writing this book comes from a letter that my family found after my grandfather. My grandfather was a Jewish Ukrainian World War II vet who'd never talked about the war ever. And when he passed away, a couple of weeks after, we found a letter that he'd written to the KGB where he confessed what happened to him during the war. And the story of what happened to him during the war turned out to be very, very different from what we had assumed and believed our whole life. And when I heard about this letter, I was very, it immediately seemed to me that this could be a good story, nonfiction or fiction. And at the time, I was a journalist. So I slowly started looking into it. And it turned out that what happened to my grandfather during World War II actually happened to several other millions of people. But their story was very much hidden away. And so I wanted to write a story about him, but what I turned out to be doing is telling a story, a part of Soviet history, part of German Nazi history that almost no one knows about and that hasn't been written about very much at all.
Was it
So
obvious to you why he
the
kept? Let me ask before you go on. Was it obvious to you then, after seeing the letter, why he didn't want to talk about it until he was gone?
that was for me the central question of the book. So I was very interested in like the facts that he laid out about what actually happened to him and how he survived. But the more interesting question, which I think made this a novel, is the psychological one. Why do we keep secrets from the people we love? Why in this time and era did he keep a secret from the government? And why, when that government, so when the Soviet Union fell apart, why did he still feel the need to keep his past from us? So it's definitely like the main psychological question that I was exploring, and it has to do with shame and a culture of shame that surrounded kind of the totalitarian regime of the Soviet Union. So I need to kind of to explain it a little bit more. I'm gonna jump back and give like a couple of facts that like no one in America basically knows, and that really grounds this narrative. So about 6 million soldiers that were fighting for the Soviet Union side of World War II were captured by the Germans, some of them very quickly, very early on when the war began. And while POW treatment, there was a law governing it, called the Geneva Convention, for those who know. However, that law did not seem to apply to anyone from the Soviet Union for various reasons I won't go into. And so these people, these 6 million people that were captured, were basically put in camps and treated really badly and very purposefully so. They were basically exterminated, not in the way, not in the same method as kind of the infamous Holocaust, the Jews, but in some similar methods. So they were starved to death. They were shot. They were driven, you know, they were driven basically to live in conditions that were fatal. Sometimes right next to them were camps of POWs from other countries, from France or Belgium, et cetera, and who were treated just across the fence completely differently. They had electricity, they had blankets, they had the Red Cross delivering food for them from their families, while right next to them, Soviet soldiers were just murdered, basically. So my grandfather, as the letter that we found revealed, he was stationed as an artilleryman early on, or right at the beginning of the war when Hitler's army attacked, was captured soon after, and then somehow managed to survive for the next 4 years. What's particularly interesting about it is that he was also Jewish. So here was a Jewish man who was a Soviet soldier who had every, the Nazis had every reason to kill him, and somehow he managed to survive. Now let's jump back, or jump forward, excuse me, 4 years later. The war ends in Europe, at least it's 1945. The Soviet army rolls in and they start bringing the people, their Soviet citizens, back to Soviet Union. The way they do that is that they set up a filtration process. They're looking for spies because they're Soviet paranoid people, and a war has been going on. They're looking for spies, and they pay particular attention to POWs who were captured and to forced laborers, which is a whole other topic that we may or may not get into, but they're basically people brought over from Ukraine, Russia, and Belarus to work for the Germans during the war. And all of these people, like millions of people, are put through these filtration camps, and they meet different fate. Some of them are sent home, some of them are put back into the army, and some of them are sent to the Soviet camps. So they go basically from being kept in like Nazi concentration camps to being put in Soviet concentration camps for many years. So all of this history, however, is very little known outside of the Soviet Union and also weirdly inside of it, because what these people who spent time in Germany during kind of Hitler's rule, they were basically viewed as potential traitors. So even though they were like captured, right? Imagine you're a soldier, you're captured, you're put in camps. Afterward, when you're released, you are then treated as a traitor because you spent time in with the Germans, and who knows what you did there. You don't have the same rights as any other soldiers. You don't get benefits when you're back. You often can't get a job. You often can't get into the university. So you really become second-class citizen. Yes, and this idea was one of the most challenging things for me to explain, because in America, POWs are not treated that way at all, right? They're not viewed as traitors in any way. But there they are. And so there's a lot of shame for the people who survived in that way. And a lot of them, I would argue most of them, never talked about it. Which means if you're a writer researching this era, there's actually not very much to go on. There's not a lot of people who wrote books about themselves being a POW or a forced labor.
So did this come easily for you in just in terms of that you had the letter, you knew your grandfather? I mean, obviously you had to build out the story, and it's a complex story, and your grandfather didn't give you a helping hand with that other than the letter. Did it come easily? Was your grandfather your muse while you were doing this? Was he in your thoughts a lot while doing it? Tell us what that experience was like. And how easily it came or didn't come.
So it took me a while to believe that I even could write the story. It did immediately feel to me like a story that somebody should write, but I swear to you, for like 10 years after finding this letter, I for some reason was convinced that my nephew, who was like 5 at the time, he's going to grow into this great writer, and one day he will inherit the story and write a novel about it. I can't tell you now why I thought that way, but I think I was afraid to face writing a World War II story. I was a journalist, as you might know. We met back then, and going from journalism, from writing articles for newspapers, to writing a 300-page novel about people who are dead, who you can't interview, is quite a big challenge. So, as you said, I had only this letter. My grandpa was dead, couldn't ask him. I had a grandma, his wife, who was alive for a few more years, who'd written a memoir about her own experience. But there wasn't that much information about the World War II side of things that my grandpa experienced. So, yes, on the one hand, I wanted to be true to telling his story. On the other hand, the only way to do it was fiction, in my opinion, because I just didn't have a lot of firsthand source materials besides his very short letter. So I decided that this was my chance to write a novel. I've always wanted to. I was, I think, just very afraid.
I was going to ask
And
you about that. So you did have ambitions to write a novel eventually.
I
This was the
did.
trigger point. This
I
started six
did.
years ago, is my understanding. 6 years ago, you were pregnant with child what, number one?
Yes.
Okay, child number one. And you had moved to Berlin.
Yes.
And you talk a little bit. I'm looking at a few notes here that then there
Yes.
was 2 years. Was it 2 years ago that you actually started writing the book?
No, so I started writing it. You're right, in Berlin. I was 7 months pregnant. We just moved to Berlin with my husband. There was another event, however, that preceded this that made me, I think, more secure in believing that I could pull off writing a World War II book about a male soldier from another era. And it was my trip to Ukraine. So in 2014, a war had broken out, a war that sort of precedes the current war that we see between Russia and Ukraine. It was a regional separatist. There was Russian-backed separatists in eastern Ukraine, and they were concentrated in my family's hometown, so where the famous grandpa and grandma lived. It was really happening in front of their apartment building. And
This was when Putin's first incursions were occurring,
correct.
and yeah, he went into Crimea and then on from there
Correct, to the Donbass, yes.
to the
So all of a
Donbass.
sudden, this peaceful city where I spent every summer growing up became a war zone pretty much overnight. My cousins who were there had to flee. My nephews who were little had to flee as well. But my grandma, who was quite old at the time and had survived World War II, said, "You know what? Let him come and get me. I am not going anywhere. This is my city, and I'm just staying right here." So she stayed there, and so did my aunt and uncle. And when a year and a half or 2 years after problems began there, it felt like it was sort of safe to visit. I mean, I'm using quotes here around the word safe, but I decided to try. I really wanted to see my grandma. She was 90. It was probably my last chance. So me and my brother went to Russia and then crossed the border. Border being a loose term I'm using, across the border into this weird separatist republic that was still very much a war zone, but it was kind of quieter. And once I saw buildings with bullet holes and heard shelling while I was rushing home during martial law time, and saw the empty streets and the empty buildings and just in a completely different city that was ravaged by war, I felt a newfound sort of confidence that I could portray war, even though this is obviously World War II is a very different situation than what we have here. But something about that experience gave me like the psychological, I don't know, confidence, I guess, that I could maybe write a war book, and then once I moved to Berlin, I saw this city that any kind of Soviet-born person really associates with World War II and Hitler. It's very hard to take like Berlin out of that context for people. And this was a city that my grandpa, I knew from the letter, had gotten to and participated in the final battle to win World War II. It carried a lot of heavy meaning for me, and all of a sudden I was there about to give birth in Berlin, seeing kind of everything in Berlin and feeling the streets, I just the book began to like pour out of me.
So when you started writing it, from the time you started writing it till you were done, say with your first draft, what time frame was that? In other words, when I say time frame, what I mean is how long did it take? How many months or years?
I don't really remember draft by draft what I can, because there was the first kid in the middle of it, and then I had another kid, and we moved back to San Francisco. There was just so much going on in life. But what I can tell you is that I was finishing maybe draft three or four, I can't even tell you, but it felt like kind of the pot possibly the final one. I was finishing the very last chapter, which takes place during the Russia-Ukraine conflict. That began when it became clear to the world that a full-scale invasion might happen. This is February 2022. Things are escalating daily. Putin is making speeches. And I end up writing an op-ed for the New York Times about my family in the Donbass, basically saying that kind of the opposite of what Putin was saying, which is we're gonna come and liberate all those poor Russian-speaking Ukrainians in the East and make them part of Russia where they belong. And I, in the op-ed, said that no, thank you. My family really never asked to be liberated. They were perfectly fine living in Ukraine and did not really want to be part of Russia. So this, as I am editing this piece, it becomes clear that he really is about to invade. And the ch situation changes daily. I have to re-edit this article daily, every morning, every evening, because it's just things are happening really quickly. And then war breaks out, and this piece runs. It gets a lot of attention, and it gets me an agent, something that I was frankly dreading,
So
looking for
the
agents.
agent approached you based on the article.
Yes, the article at the very bottom, it said Sasha Vasilyuk is working on a novel set in Ukraine. That's kind of all it said, but
Okay.
it was enough that she asked, what is this novel? And I'm like, well, I actually happen to be finishing it right now if you want to take a look. And so I signed with that agent. I talked to a couple of others as well, and then the book just went on sale immediately after.
Interesting. So, I'm curious how cinematic the book is in turn. Do you think that this lends itself to a limited streaming series or a 2-hour movie? I hate to make that jump when the book is only on pre-order right now, and I'm a big believer in a book is a much more complete version than what they end up doing on the screen. But at the same time, I can't help but notice that when you watch Netflix and other streaming services, there's so many of these shows now that are based on novels, and they're obviously looking for material. World War II is a huge subject for people, a huge
Yes.
subject both in terms of interest and just it's the war that that was the whole world was at war, so to speak. So,
Yes.
what about that?
I find that I think that it is cinematic. I can imagine it. We've all seen World War II movies, so maybe it's sort of it's just easy to imagine it being set. However, World War II movies are very expensive to produce. And so, I don't know. I'm not holding my breath for this to become like a major film or
Well,
anything.
we have artificial intelligence now, AI, computer generation and all
Oh
that. There's
God.
it's amazing what can be done without it's a sad thing too, because it puts a lot of people out of business, but at the same time, it's become so the things that are possible nowadays are absolutely amazing. But at any rate, the subject matter certainly is one that we've seen taken to the silver screen before, and of course it could be again. And this is an aspect of the war that is very little known or virtually unknown.
If you sort of Google like Soviet POWs, you will encounter a sentence that says that this is one of the worst military crimes in history, kind of their treatment, which is interesting because it's also one of the least studied and known one. But yeah.
Yeah, awful. You have made this transition from journalism to fiction writing. There's so many it seems like a very natural step in one way, and many people have done it, but at the same time, there's so many journalists who have made that attempt and realized, wow, this is not a simple, it's not really a natural step. It's a huge departure from reporting from sources and then putting together a nonfiction story, which kind of dopes itself out along the way. With fiction writing, when you're relying on largely on your imagination, obviously a lot of research too, but largely on the imagination, that's a whole different ball game. Was it a natural progression for you, or transition for you, or did you find it to be kind of arresting in a way? Even Tom Wolfe, the great Tom Wolfe, The Right Stuff and Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. When he started writing novels, he admitted he was crestfallen. He couldn't get it. He couldn't make it happen. And he stuck with it, of course, and broke through and finally was able to write The Bonfire of the Vanities. But it just goes to show even a person of his experience and skill had a really rough time of it. That's not to say it was a, it's the same for everybody. I'm curious what your experience was in crossing over.
Yeah, so I think there's two parts to it. One is a simple one. One is length, right? If you are Tom Wolfe and you're right, or other, some other journalist who's written nonfiction books that are book length, and you understand the kind of the time commitment and the perseverance that that takes, I think, right, that's one change from being just like a daily journalist, to writing a novel. It's just the sheer like time commitment that you're doing. Years instead of hours or days. And the second one is, of course, the making stuff up. So I always wanted to be a writer. Journalism became kind of the departure for me. I kind of took that road early on in life, but it was a way to write. It was like a professional way to write. That's kind of how I thought about it. And I then kind of got stuck, I guess, in journalism and in reality. But I did secretly want to be a novelist. That was like the big aspiration in life. I was just really afraid to do it. I think for me, writing a book that is very much steeped in reality, both historical and using some family things that I know, was a way in. Like I don't think I could have gone from journalism to writing like a sci-fi book set in, some future era, right? Like that was too much of a departure. But I also really like realist books, not necessarily historical, it could be contemporary too, but just really, really steeped in like the reality of what it is to be a human being. I find books that are too like melodramatic or kind of soap operas just, I don't know, they just don't work for me as well. And so, yeah, so this was my way in. I was always afraid that if I write something, I wouldn't be like fiction wise, I wouldn't be able to make it believable. Somehow that was like always the fear, and that's how I phrased it myself. Like, what if nobody believes that this is real. And when I started writing fictional scenes, I remember wrote my first little scene and I was like, oh, okay. I wasn't really sure that my brain could basically imagine. I mean, we all imagine, we all dream things, right? Whatever, but somehow I was so stuck in like the reality of journalism that I didn't know that I had that muscle. But when I wrote that first scene, and all of a sudden I could sort of see things happening, as if it was like imagine kind of a narrow door and then it's opening wider and wider and you see a room and the light is a certain way and all of a sudden it smells and then a person comes in and they're wearing these things and all of a sudden you see it and like it was just kind of incredible.
So
It
this was
really,
your experience, kind of in the theater of your own mind. You were seeing and hearing and smelling things as you were imagining and writing. Is that am I understanding? Yeah, that's amazing. It is amazing. It just shows how vivid this well, writing is for you, and it is for some people. But I think why so many people fall flat with their writing, even if they're successful in publishing a novel, let's say. Oftentimes the writing is very flat, and I think it's very much for the reason that they don't have that theater of the mind really. It's just not accessible to them. They don't think in real visual terms. And you're talking about, it's not even just visual. You're talking about all of the senses being engaged, which is really the height of it. The whole, show don't tell, but when you show it, hit all of the senses as much as possible. So that was happening to you even as you were writing. That's fantastic. Let me ask you about now that you've done it, you've crossed the Rubicon, you are a published author, and there's a lot of excitement around this book. We can see that. The subject matter is perfect for right now. And now that you have actually achieved this, are you already thinking about what your next novel is? Do you already have something in mind?
Yes, I began writing my next novel last summer. I had to put it on hold for the last few months because of just this book is taking a lot of, there's a lot of marketing, PR, and all kinds of stuff that needs to happen for this one. But I keep thinking about that one that's waiting for me on the computer. It is more contemporary, and has to do a little bit still with the Eastern Europe, but also with America. Your presence is mandatory. There's nothing, all of it takes place somewhere else. None of it takes place in the US. And obviously, I've lived here for a very long time. So I'm looking forward to working on things that are a little more familiar, that I don't need to research like every single tidbit of,
So can you tell us about, now it's early on, and I know some writers are superstitious. Can you give us a just kind of a gesture drawing of what this novel is about? Or I totally understand if you want to keep that tucked in the vest pocket for now.
Yeah, I would say it's too early. I can tell you some things that I'm thinking about in
Sure.
general. And some of them are a little bit autobiographical. I'm thinking of sort of what kind of on bigger topics, like what happens to democracy and how easy it is for it to disappear. I'm
Another
talking,
very contemporary story would
yeah,
be.
I am talking about Russia here in particular, because I kind of saw it happen. I went there in 2012 when there was kind of the last big, first and last, I suppose, big wave of anti-government, anti-Putin protests. And I went to them, I met Navalny, and I just kind of saw it. I was supposed to report on one of them, and it turned out to be so boring that I the editor didn't need a story about it. It was like so clear to me that this movement was not going to win. And
What
so
was boring about it? Was Navalny boring when you met with
no,
him?
it was just there was no energy. Like you could feel standing there among people. There was a woman next to me who at some point while all these people were making speeches, there was a group of them making speeches. People were standing watching the speeches, and a woman next to me started unwrapping a sandwich that she had brought. And something about that, this woman with her sandwich, having studied and seen sort of like the Russian Revolution, which is the only other big revolution kind of historically that happened in that place, it was clear to me that this was not the energy of a revolution. That if these people are just standing there quietly, none of them look like they believed in any change. They were there, they showed up, but none of them like fully believed in it. You could just tell, you could just sort of feel it.
Is that part of the nature, though, of the Russian people?
Oh God, here we go. This is
I
a good
mean,
question.
am I speaking in a stereo? Maybe I'm speaking in a stereotype, but it does, from afar, it just seems that the kind of spirit of America is not something you find everywhere. And Russia seems to, they've done a lot of suffering in that country, as you know. The history there, the Stalinism and so on, World War II and the Nazis and such. There's a stoicism, it seems, about the Russian people, and they don't get too excited about anything, because it's been a rough history, let's put it that way.
It's a stereotype that happens to be true, so I don't blame you for it at all. I think there's a lot of apolitical feelings there. I felt for a very long time, even in 2012, the scene that I was kind of setting for you, I felt like I didn't really care about politics. I didn't want to write about politics as a journalist. I wanted to write about art and fluffier things. And only now, kind of having written this book and having now watched a smaller war, my family suffer from war, and then this huge war start all over Ukraine, do I realize what the danger is of being so apathetic and apolitical? And now, not that like I want to become a political writer or an activist, really, but I feel like it's much more important than I've ever realized.
Well, and
And that's
you've
good.
witnessed the domino effect, right? I mean, we see it
Yep.
in Hungary. We saw it in Brazil. We have seen it in a multitude of nations, the so-called strong men who are democratically elected, and that's the last democratic election, really democratic election that they hold. And now here in the United States, we're very worried about that coming to pass. You know,
Yep.
the United States is used to feeling like we're the nation that leads, but in this case, it seems like we're following. We're kind of at the tail end of this kind of populism and this strongman fascination and syndrome. So I don't know, I just throw that out there for your evaluation.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I don't want to talk too much about politics. This is a complicated year for the United States and the election, obviously. But yes, I have watched my two homelands start a war with each other because of a strong man. And yes, it was a domino effect, and it started all innocently, and people were distracted, and then all of a sudden it was too late. And so, this is something that I'm thinking a lot about as I watch what happens. Putin now will be in power unless he dies until 2030. And just hearing that year just scares the shit out of me, pardon me.
Yeah, no, that's fine. No,
And
I get
you
it.
know, a long, long, long time. And that's how Soviet rulers used to be. They used to sit there forever until they were just too old and decrepit, and then they die, and then the next one came, you know. So just to see it happening again in our modern 21st century is bizarre. And anyway, it's and the, so back to kind of the book I'm thinking about is that what's hard about it is what's easier to write about historical fiction in a way, because we all know how World War II ended, right? I don't know how this situation with Russia, with the war in Ukraine, will end. I have no idea. So writing anything contemporary, you're constantly kind of a slave to the news cycle a little bit. And I don't want to put myself into that position. So I'm trying to figure out how to do that. And I think the way to do that is to focus on something very personal. Like, I'm not writing a political book. I think that's the background. I think what I am writing about more is kind of an immigrant story, a father-daughter story, potentially. So things that are a little bit closer and personal and,
Right. There's always that decision to be made between the macrocosm and the microcosm. And when you write, it's like I think it was Don Murray, the great journalism writing coach, who said, don't write about the army, write about one soldier. Because that one soldier, now I'm adding this is my own extension of that. Just that one soldier embodies the whole experience. I mean, if you pick the right soldier and you make that man or woman emblematic of the entire battle, and you can always scale up from there, because obviously that character is going to exist within a platoon or a company or what have you. And it is much more personal when you take it, and people care about a character. Even Stalin said, for crying out loud, a million dead is a statistic. No, one dead is a tragedy. A million dead is a statistic. He would know. But that whole that so it sounds like that's what you were talking about, is this is going to be a little is closer, more personal, more microcosm than macrocosm. Is that right?
And I think, delving into, I'm interested in delving into personal psychological human experience. And obviously, we are all affected and stressed by things that happen in the world around us. But we also have our personal drama that kind of is affected by it or not, that might coincide with it. And I think this was very fun for me to do in Your Presence is Mandatory, is that yes, I was working on World War II and Soviet history, that's as big of a subject as it gets, really. But what I was really writing about is a marriage of two people, that's complicated by certain things, by secrecy, by shame, by different pasts and different hopes, maybe, and about growing up in a certain way and not knowing things about your parents, which is, right, an experience that many of us have in different forms or shapes. And all of that, things in the background, history happening in the background, kind of weaves in and out of the personal experience. And so I really enjoyed that part of it, kind of deciding how much of each to have, the micro and the macro, and how to use the micro to demonstrate the macro, not in a super obvious way, not in like a, news article kind of way, as we're taught in journalism, but really in the way you said, like, pick a soldier, talk about their personal experience, and through that, we will see a huge picture of what's happening to millions of people.
And just to underscore that, I remember some research I had seen on it was Save the Children, and they sent out, of course, they test mailers which one performs better. And one mailer was basically saying, 10 million children starving in Africa. And the other one was just, baby Jessica is dying. And the baby Jessica dying totally outperformed the one about 10 million children starving, because I can just imagine so many, 10 million kids, what can I possibly do about that? But when it becomes baby Jessica, it becomes the microcosm. Here's one child. I can save a child. I can save one. I can mail a check in. She can become my adopted, daughter out there, so to speak, financially. So it just plays out that way, that we really connect with individuals. If it's a mass group, that's much more difficult, as you even saw with the Navalny supporters, where there was kind of the lack of real spirit there, and enthusiasm, and maybe belief. What was it like meeting Navalny? Did you get to spend any quality time with him, any alone time to interview him, or were you part of a room full of journalists talking to him?
I did not. So I was actually at a party. This was like kind of a very chic, exclusive event that happens once, or used to happen once a year in Moscow. And I happen to have a journalist friend who was based in Moscow, and he just took me as his plus one. And I wasn't somebody who like followed Russian or Ukrainian politics for that matter. I lived here in the US, and I kind of vaguely, I saw the news that everyone else saw. And I'd heard his name, but didn't really know what he looked like or anything. He was very tall, so he was like easier to spot in a room full, at a party, in a room full of
Another
people.
reason why Putin hated him.
Probably, right? Short
No.
man complex. So my journalist friend came up to shake his hand and introduce me, and I found him a little like awkward somehow. I think he
Is he
got
shy?
that. Yeah, he was just a little shy and awkward, like tall person stooping a little bit to shake like the hand of a short woman, random woman, and though it was really, it didn't extend beyond that. I feel now that I feel like so lucky that I was even in the same room with him at some point, because I feel like he, I don't know that he knew at the time what he was gonna do, how much he was, how big of a symbol he was going to become. I think it was too early for him to know that. And watching his journey and seeing this huge sacrifice, I feel like it's so rare these days for anybody to do that. We've all gotten pretty selfish. And this is like going back to a country where you're gonna get arrested. And then sending these letters to your wife, like it feels like a 19th century story, and so few people are willing to do that there and elsewhere, really. But that it was just admirable. I had a very interesting conversation a couple of days ago at a kid's birthday party, where a Ukrainian woman who lives here confessed to me that she felt very sad about Navalny passing, but felt like she couldn't share her sadness with her Ukrainian friends. And she was sort of confessing this to me, and I found it so kind of sad that the internet has generally made us all very siloed. and kind of right pushing us to the extremes. But war plus internet is really just a recipe for a disaster for these like bubbles to
Yeah.
form and suck you in and keep you in them.
And the misinformation, they've said long before we had social media, the first victim of war is the truth. I
Yeah.
mean, in the United States, I mean, if we're going to go to war with somebody, here comes the propaganda. Not to say that we're not necessarily justified in the war, but to try to build support, the first thing that happens is we demonize somebody who was never demonized before. We weren't doing that before, but we are now. And
Yeah.
it's just the nature of government and trying to whip up support for a war,
Yeah.
or any
And
movement for that matter. And then this is how it plays out. I can tell you that when Navalny was killed by that bastard Putin, that my wife and I both were we you know we were both felt a great sadness. It just that here was a guy, like you said, who was leading a movement, showed incredible bravery. Now it's been picked up by his wife. And I would not be surprised if his wife is not the president of Russia one day, when this whole thing plays out. And I think she's wisely staying off of Russian soil, because that's just, obviously a formula for suicide, basically.
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I wonder, you know, there's a lot of Russian refugees or kind of immigrants, I guess, in European capitals, just kind of sitting around, moping, and not they don't really know what to do. And there's a precedent to this. When the Russian Revolution happened, a lot of people immigrated to Europe, like Nabokov and others. And they also sat around Paris and Berlin trying to figure out what to do. And as history showed, nothing they didn't do, there's nothing they could have done, or at least they didn't do anything that changed anything. And so it's, you know, it's worrying seeing history repeat itself in this way. I really hope it ends up differently.
Yeah,
I just
that's what's
wanted to just say something about what you were saying about demonizing, because that's exactly what was happening to all these people who survived World War II in this way. And part of like sort of like my mission with this book, if you could have a mission with a novel, right, which may or may not be a problematic thing to begin with, but it really is, I wanted to bring a story that would otherwise not exist, right? Soviet government, like, was the master of propaganda, and there was all this private suffering sort of hidden underneath this like collective gilded exterior in Soviet history. We all thought of our own history in a certain way, but because our grandparents who survived certain things never told us the reality, there was like no one to correct the Soviet narrative, right? The stuff that we read in textbooks. I think private stories have they're very important, because they can tell us something that, you know, that our state does not want us to know or to understand. And it's important to have those two things. And now the repercussions of not knowing is that somebody like Putin is rewriting Soviet history, is rewriting Russia's and Ukraine's history, and is using, like, abusing kind of the trauma of World War II to wage this new war. And it's just incredible to watch, like, history being kind of used that way.
Yeah, warped and used in that way, absolutely. So, to get back to the writing, I know we've veered off, but I mean it's all connected. What about when what was the turn was there a turning point in the writing of the novel? Did you reach a certain point where it kind of coalesced for you, or you understood where it was going to go and how it was going to end, and that suddenly accelerated the writing and the storytelling. Was there a point like that, or was it basically the same pace from beginning to end, and the same struggle that all writers go through when trying to
put together, so many different words and vignettes and so on.
That's an interesting question. I feel like finding my writing group really helped me reach kind of that second level that I wasn't really reaching on my own. I joined, I feel like on somewhere in draft two, I found this amazing writing group in San Francisco that accepted me. And everyone there was much more accomplished than I was, which was great for me because you always want to learn, from people who are better at you than you. And that really helped. It made me kind of both produce work at a faster level because we were meeting every 2 weeks and I had to show up with stuff. So that was really helpful, but also the critique, obviously. Because I am an immigrant writer, and yes, I mean, I've been in the US since I was 13. So I speak both languages and I'm kind of steeped in my old culture as well. It was really helpful to have American readers read my work and tell me honestly things that aren't clear or that they don't know. Because I kind of, when you come from a place, you sort of assume everyone else knows as much as you do about that place, but that is not the case. So that was really helpful as well. And that, I would say my writing group really sped things up and deepened things. And then I would say this, like the really great stuff happened after I sold the book, funny enough, with my incredible editor at Bloomsbury. She, because we sold this book really quickly, it certainly wasn't in like the perfect shape yet. And she was willing to do the work and help me with it. And I feel like I learned so much through that process. It was very difficult to go through the edits. And one of the things I would say that I had the hardest time was kind of getting at like depth of psychology of my characters. Plotting was sort of easier for me because I was basing off, a war that really happened. And so I kind of, we all know how it ends. It was like really just getting the psychology that was tough. And my editor helped. She asked the right questions. And I think when these th those that's the sign of a great editor for me, when they ask the right question that makes you figure out the answer and really expand your narrative or deepen your story. So
So was
yeah,
she
that
able, it sounds like she was able to help you find ways to express the psychology in the writing.
yeah, she just kind of pointed out places to deepen. There's a male friendship at the heart of the book, in the part. So there's a World War II part that's half of the book, and then the other half is from World War II to now. And during World War II, there's a male friendship that's there. I am not a man. I'm not a soldier. I'm not at war. There's all these things, right, that I am very far away from. And she really helped me bring that friendship to kind of a whole new level, depth-wise and psychology-wise. She just kind of knew
That's alchemy, isn't
where
it?
to extend.
That's out. It's like alchemy, and I think, and I don't know if this was your experience or not, but I think that one of the ways that writers overshoot sometimes is that to actually make the point and convey to the reader, say a relationship, it can be just a very small gesture, or just a mark of distinction between the two. That just conveys the whole thing. That contained within that is a much bigger story, and the reader expands it from there in their own way, and not through a lot of internal verbiage, but simply, it's almost like a thought pattern that I get it. These two men are that this relationship they have and this thing they have in common, or this conflict they once had that has actually bonded them. Or what have you.
Exactly. Yeah, sometimes it doesn't take very much, but that's hard,
Yeah,
It's
oh,
hard
it's
to find
very hard, absolutely.
that one thing that's gonna do
Because
the work.
I think the instinct most of the time is to write more words, just like elaborate. Let's keep elaborating on this to make sure that the reader gets it. And then we end up with kind of that well, I'm forgetting the movie director, kind of jumping to movies now, but basically taking a sledgehammer to the reader, and it's kind of like the reader gets it. We don't have to be that explicit. Give the reader credit for understanding. They wouldn't be reading fiction if they didn't know how to interpret and how to enlarge what you're telling them. So there's always that. Let me ask you about your writing regimen. I always like to ask writers about this. What time of day, how many hours do you put in, or minutes? Where do you, are you an itinerant writer? Do you move from coffee shop to the beach to here and there, or do you always write in the same place? There are some people who believe writing in the same place is very important. Other people are stimulated by different environments. What's your method?
So I was writing this book while having two kids, which means that I was writing it during nap time. At some point when I had my second kid, I hired a nanny from Ukraine, actually, and she would come for 5 hours, and one of which was lunch, so really just left me 4 hours to write. And I didn't, because I had two kids in an apartment in San Francisco, I didn't have my own office until very recently. So I would go into, I'd like set up this tiny, tiny little desk and a kitchen chair that I would drag to my one kid's room while the baby napped in another room. And it was just so. I was always very jealous, and I see this question a lot in interviews about writers, and I'm always very jealous of the responses that many writers give about their own desk and all this inspiration that they hung on their wall, because I had none of this. I just had like kids' drawings and a wooden kitchen chair and a tiny little thing. But I don't know, like I'm not that picky. I don't think it made any difference whatsoever. I was just so strapped for time with kids and work and pandemic and moving and all of that like whatever, as long as I have like some time to do it, it sort of didn't matter where I was, or how I was doing it.
So you pieced it together, and I mean that's the way. I was just an interview with a biographer of Ray Bradbury, and that's very much the way he wrote. He would get up when he was at home. He'd get up in the morning, and of course, but as he became famous and he was doing much more traveling, and he was asked to speak at things and make appearances, it was catch as catch can. If he had 10 minutes to sit down and start scribbling in his notebook.
I did have an experience maybe a year ago. I went to AWP, the Big Writers Conference, and I was in a hotel room. And I'd always read, there's like some writers who really are into hotel rooms, but I never understood it. Like Toni Morrison is a famous example. And I was like, why? Like, what's up with hotel rooms? It seems like a weird thing. Can't you just work from home and write from home? And then I found myself in this hotel room, and I can tell you, I barely went to any panels because I finally understood the magic of a hotel room. It has zero distractions. It has no children. It has no fridge with food. It has no stove to cook. It has like no, just there's nothing. There's a bed and a desk and a chair. And my Wi-Fi didn't even work, which was amazing. And like a gym downstairs, if you really, need to exercise. I barely went to any panel. I was writing. I was so happy. I got so much done. I had, like wrote three chapters. It was just amazing. So now I'm like, oh, I see. I see what the life without distractions really is like. Now I
Yeah, kind of the power of isolation when you're I don't know about you, but also I talk to a lot of executives who get their best work done on airplanes, and I
Oh,
tend to
yeah.
get a lot of work done on airplanes because most people don't want to talk. They all have their personal devices, and I don't want to talk. I'd rather just have my laptop out there and be working on something. So you
Airplanes
find
are
that
produced.
also to be a good working time for you if you're on a jetliner.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, also like just the lot, like not being able to connect to the internet or having to pay for it or something, it just really helps me. Because I think it is distracting, and email in particular. Yeah, I have gotten so much, like so many articles, so many op-eds written. They're good. They're also, I think there's something about the fact that it's a flight that will end, and you know exactly, it's like having a deadline, when you're a newspaper journalist. Right? And we've all been trained that way. You have 2 more hours. That means like you're just gonna be super efficient. And I think the same mental technique works with a nap time, right? Or like a nanny. You know she's gonna leave at 4 and that's it. You'll be screwed afterwards. So you really better use this
Yeah.
time super wisely and not get distracted.
Yeah, it kind of accelerates things because yeah, the clock is ticking. It's the countdown is underway. Yeah, absolutely. It's really true. So the book is called Your Presence is Mandatory. And the author, you've been listening to her for about the past hour now. Her name is Sasha Vasiljic. And you can pre-order Your Presence is Mandatory on any major book-selling site. Amazon, Barnes and Noble, and so on,
Or your
iBooks,
indie bookstore.
and at your indie bookstore as well. Sasha, congratulations. This sounds like a really exciting kickoff to your fiction writing career. And I wish you all the best. And thank you for coming on the program.
Mike, thank you so much for your gracious of you to have.